Chapter 4 Value Lock-in. The Hundred Schools of Thought. In the 6th century BC in China, the collapse of the Zhou dynasty brought about a long period of conflict, now known as the Warring States era. But this collapse also led to a vibrant era of philosophical and cultural experimentation, a golden age of Chinese philosophy, later known as the Hundred Schools of Thought. During the Hundred Schools of Thought, philosophers would travel from state to state, developing their ideas and trying to persuade the political elite of their theories, moral commitments, and policy proposals. Of the Hundred Schools, there were 4 leading philosophies. Best known to us now is the philosophy of Kung Fu Tzu, or Master Kung, better known in the West as Confucius. Confucians focused on promoting self-cultivation and moral refinement. They thought that if you made a lifelong commitment to self-improvement, you could transform spiritually into a sage. They likened cultivating your character to craftsmanship, cutting bone, carving a piece of horn, or polishing a piece of jade. Among other things, spiritual nobility involved the mastery of a range of social norms and cultural rituals advocated by the Confucians, as well as the careful refinement of your emotions. Confucians encouraged obedience to authority, respect for your parents, and partiality to your family, rulers, and state. Rather than punishing wrong actions, Confucian legal principles punished wrong relationships. A son beating a father was a serious crime. A father beating a son was not. A second school we now call legalism. Somewhat similar to Machiavellianism, legalism took a dim view of human nature, regarding people as innately wicked and selfish. It emphasized the necessity of heavy punishments to prevent wrongdoing and the political importance of a wealthy government and a powerful military. Third, there were the anti-authoritarian ideas expressed in the Tao Te Ching and the Zhuangzi that later scholars referred to as Taoism. These books have traditionally been attributed to Lao Tzu, Old Master, and Zhuangzi, Master Zhuang, respectively. Taoists believed that the Confucian attempt to control the world by promoting a rigid and unchanging set of social norms was foolhardy. They instead advocated spontaneous, non-coercive action that anticipates and responds to the ebb and flow of the world. Finally, there were the Moists, followers of the 5th century BC philosopher Mozi, or Master Mo. Even though they are little known today, they were the main rival of the Confucians. They were so influential that their Confucian contemporary Mengzi said their teachings seemed to fill the world. The Moists argued that we should care about others just as much as we care for ourselves, and that we should pursue whatever policies will produce the most benefit for all people. They were the first consequentialists, endorsing the view that we should take whatever actions produce the best outcomes. Their philosophy has many similarities to that of the British utilitarians, John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham. The Moists just got there 2,000 years earlier. Putting their radical ideas into practice, they argued that, to avoid wasting resources, people shouldn't own luxuries or consume too much. They condemned the widespread nepotism of the time and advocated meritocracy instead. Being particularly distressed by war, some Moists formed paramilitary groups devoted to protecting weaker cities. One commentator likened them to Jedi Knights. There were bitter rivalries and intense criticism between these different schools. The Confucian philosopher Zhuangzi wrote, "If your method is to follow Mozi, then you may wander across the whole world, and even if you reach every corner of it, no one will not consider you base." The Hundred Schools of Thought ended in 221 BC, when the legalism-influenced Qin conquered all of China and tried to purge any dissent from the new orthodoxy. The emperor ordered the burning of unapproved books and prohibited all private learning. Disobedience was punished with death, and over 400 dissenting scholars were murdered. Legalism seemed to have won the war of ideas. Confucianism survived, but its influence was modest. The first Qin emperor was obsessed with the endurance of his rule. He declared that his empire would last for 10,000 generations, took advice from magicians who claimed they could create elixirs of immortality, and funded expeditions in search of mythical immortal beings. His search was in vain, and he died in 210 BC at the age of 49. Popular revolt broke out after the emperor's death, and after years of conflict between competing factions, the Han general Liu Bang became the founding emperor of the Han dynasty. The 10,000 generation Qin Empire lasted just 15 years. By now, legalism had been tainted by its association with the Qin and its oppressive policies. During the first years of the Han, imperial decisions were informed by a blend of legalism, Confucianism, and Taoism. Confucianism had no special status initially, but a combination of luck and skillful politicking meant that Confucianism soon emerged as the orthodox ideology of the Chinese Empire. Emperor Zhuan, who reigned from 74 to 48 BC, made Han Dynasty China the first Confucian Empire. Of course, the Confucians still had to contend with competitors. After the fall of the Western Han Dynasty, Buddhism spread throughout China, and for much of the relatively open Tang Dynasty of AD 618 to 907, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism were all popular and tolerated by the state. But starting in the mid-9th century, Confucianism once again emerged as China's dominant public ideology. For over 1,000 years, every educated person in China was required to master the Confucian canon, and for 700 of those years, basic literacy was taught via the Sanzi Jing, a Confucian classic written especially for children. Today, more than 2,500 years after Confucius's death, Confucianism's influence in China has waned. It lost its position as official state philosophy in 1912, when it became fashionable to see Confucianism as an obstacle to China's economic development. But the influence of Confucianism on the history of China and other Confucian heritage countries is undeniable. Even today, people from Confucian heritage countries have distinctively Confucian views on what they think is important in life, how they expect their children to behave, and what their hopes are for the future. But if events had unfolded differently 2,000 years ago, plausibly instead it could have been legalism, Taoism, Moism, or some blend of these that ruled China for 2,000 years. The persistence of values. Values can be highly persistent. A familiar but remarkable fact is that the best-selling book this year, as every year, is the Bible, completed almost 2,000 years ago. The second best-selling book is the Quran. Confucius's Analects still sells hundreds of thousands of copies annually. Every day, quotes from these sources influence political decision-making around the world. The Babylonian Talmud, compiled over a millennium ago, states that the embryo is considered to be mere water until the 40th day, and today Jews tend to have much more liberal attitudes towards stem cell research than Catholics, who object to this use of embryos because they believe life begins at conception. Similarly, centuries-old dietary restrictions are still widely followed, as evidenced by India's unusually high rates of vegetarianism, a $20 billion kosher food market, and many Muslims' abstinence from alcohol. In this chapter, I discuss value lock-in, an event that causes a single value system or set of value systems to persist for an extremely long time. Value lock-in would end or severely curtail the moral diversity and upheaval that we are used to. If value lock-in occurred globally, then how well or poorly the future goes would be determined in significant part by the nature of those locked-in values. Some changes in values might still occur, but the broad moral contours of society would have been set, and the world would enact one of only a small number of futures compared to all those that were possible. The rise of Confucianism illustrates the phenomenon of lock-in. The Qin tried and failed to lock in legalism. The Han succeeded in locking in Confucianism for over 1,000 years. But the lock-in that could occur this century or the next might last much longer, even indefinitely. This sounds extreme, and as a warning, this chapter will discuss some ideas that will seem weird or sci-fi. But technology is changing rapidly, and technological advances could radically alter the dynamic of moral change that we are used to. When taking the interests of future generations seriously, we simply cannot dismiss major technological advances out of hand. Consider how someone in 1600 would react to the idea that within 24 generations, we would be able to make light and fire with a flick of a switch and would do so dozens of times a day without a second thought. Or that we could see anyone, anywhere in the world, immediately, in real time, on a device we carried in our pocket. Or that we could fly in the skies or walk in a celestial body. We simply know that, given continued technological progress, there will be major change over the coming centuries. Previous technology has already enabled values to persist for longer and with higher fidelity than they could otherwise have done. Writing, for example, was crucial, enabling complex ideas to be transmitted many generations into the future, without inevitable distortion by the failures of human memory. The persistence of religious values, or moral worldviews like Confucianism, would not have been possible without writing as a technology. In Chapter 2, I describe the phenomenon of early plasticity, later rigidity. That it can be much easier to influence the norms, standards, and laws surrounding a technology, idea, or country when they are still new than later on, when things have settled. In China, the Hundred Schools of Thought was a period of plasticity. Like still molten glass, during this time the philosophical culture of China could be blown into one of many shapes. By the time of the Song Dynasty, the culture was more rigid. The glass had cooled and set. It was still possible for ideological change to occur, but it was much more difficult than before. We are now living through the global equivalent of the Hundred Schools of Thought. Different moral worldviews are competing, and no single worldview has yet won out. It's possible to alter and influence which ideas have prominence. But technological advances could cause this long period of diversity and change to come to an end. When thinking about Locke, the key technology is artificial intelligence. Writing gave ideas the power to influence society for thousands of years. Artificial intelligence could give them influence that lasts millions. I'll discuss when this might occur later. For now, let's focus on why advanced artificial intelligence would be of such great long-term importance. Artificial general intelligence. Artificial intelligence, AI, is a branch of computer science that aims to design machines that can mimic or replicate human intelligence. Because of the success of machine learning as a paradigm, we've made enormous progress in AI over the last 10 years. Machine learning is a method of creating useful algorithms that does not require explicitly programming them. Instead, it relies on learning from data such as images, the results of computer games, or patterns of mouse clicks. One well-publicized breakthrough was DeepMind's AlphaGo in 2016, which beat 18-time international champion Go player Lee Sedol. But AlphaGo is just a tiny sliver of all the impressive achievements that have come out of recent developments in machine learning. There have also been breakthroughs in generating and recognizing speech, images, art, and music, in real-time strategy games like StarCraft, and in a wide variety of tasks associated with understanding and generating human-like text. You probably use artificial intelligence every day, for example, in a Google search. AI has also driven significant improvements in voice recognition, email text completion, and machine translation. The ultimate achievement of AI research would be to create artificial general intelligence, or AGI, a single system or collection of systems working together that is capable of learning as wide an array of tasks as human beings can, and performing them to at least the same level as human beings. Once we develop AGI, we will have created artificial agents, beings, not necessarily conscious, that are capable of forming plans and executing on them, in just the way that human beings can. An AGI could learn not only to play board games, but also to drive, to have conversations, to do mathematics, and countless other tasks. So far, artificial intelligence has been narrow. AlphaGo is extraordinarily good at playing Go, but is incapable of doing anything else. But some of the leading AI labs, such as DeepMind and OpenAI, have the explicit goal of building AGI. And there have been indications of progress, such as the performance of GPT-3, an AI language model which can perform a variety of tasks it was never explicitly trained to perform, such as translation or arithmetic. AlphaZero, a successor to AlphaGo, taught itself how to play not only Go, but also chess and shogi, ultimately achieving world-class performance. About 2 years later, Muzio achieved the same feat despite initially not even knowing the rules of the game. The development of AGI would be of monumental long-term importance for two reasons. First, it might greatly speed up the rate of technological progress, economic growth, or both. These arguments date back over 60 years to early computer science pioneer I.J. Goode, who worked in Bletchley Park to break the German Enigma code during World War II, alongside Alan Turing and, as it happens, my grandmother, Daphne Crouch. Recently, the idea has been analysed by mainstream growth economists, including Nobel laureate William Nordhaus. There are two ways in which AGI could accelerate growth. First, a country could grow the size of its economy indefinitely, simply by producing more AI workers. The country's growth rate would then rise to the very fast rate at which we can build more AIs. Analysing this scenario, Nordhaus found that if the AI workers also improve in productivity over time because of continuing technological progress, then growth will accelerate without bound until we run into physical limits. The second consideration is that, via AGI, we could automate the process of technological innovation. We have already seen this recently to some extent. DeepMind's machine learning system AlphaFold 2 made a huge leap forward towards solving the protein folding problem, that is, how to predict what shape a protein will take, reaching a level of performance that had been regarded as decades away. If AGI could quite generally automate the process of innovation, the rate of technological progress we have seen to date would greatly increase. This acceleration would apply to the design of AI systems themselves, in a positive feedback loop. This idea was formalized in a model by some leading growth economists. Again, they found that AI could produce extraordinarily fast and accelerating rates of growth. It's not inevitable that AI will impact technological progress in this way. Indeed, the authors of the models I've referenced emphasize that accelerating growth rates hold only under some conditions. Perhaps, for example, there are some crucial inputs that are very hard to automate. Perhaps these include the manufacturing of computer chips, or the mining of ores to create those chips, or the building of power plants to power the server farms the AI systems rely on. If so, then the slow growth in these areas would constrain the overall rate of progress. However, given the clear mechanisms by which AI could generate far faster growth rates, we should take this possibility very seriously. Economies could double in size over months or years rather than decades. This might seem implausible, but remarkably, moving to much faster rates of economic growth would be a continuation of historical trends. We are used to thinking about growth in terms of a steady exponential, where a country's economy grows by a few percent every year. But over the long run, growth rates have accelerated. In the early agricultural era, the global rate of economic growth was around 0.1% per year. Nowadays, it is around 3% per year. Before the Industrial Revolution, it took many centuries for the world economy to double in size. Now it doubles every 25 years. It's not clear how best to understand this. Perhaps history was a succession of distinct exponential growth modes, moving from a hunter-gatherer economic era to an agricultural era to an industrial era. Or perhaps economic history is just a single faster-than-exponential but noisy trend, with rates of growth steadily accelerating over time. In this latter view, the last 100 years of relatively stable growth rates are anomalously slow. But in either the growth modes view or the single faster-than-exponential trend view, we should be open to the idea that growth rates might be much higher in the future than they are today. Given that growth rates have increased 30-fold since the agricultural era, it's not crazy to think that they might increase 10-fold again. But if they did, the world economy would double every 2.5 years. An increase in the rate of technological progress is the first reason why AGI would be a monumental event. The second reason, crucial from a long-term perspective, is AGI's potential longevity. In Chapter 1, we saw that Shakespeare and Horace really might have achieved immortality through their poetry. Information can persist indefinitely because the cost to replicate it is so tiny. But software is just complex information. It can be replicated easily. For example, one of the first commercially available computer games was Pong by Atari, released in 1977. You can still play it today online. Though eventually all original Atari consoles will rust and crumble, Pong will live on. The software that defines Pong is replicable, and if every future generation is willing to pay the tiny cost of replicating this little piece of history, it will continue to persist. Pong could last as long as civilization does. There's nothing different, in principle, between the software that encodes Pong and the software that encodes an AGI. Since that software can be copied with high fidelity, an AGI can survive changes in the hardware instantiating it. AGI agents are potentially immortal. AI and entrenchment. These two features of AGI, potentially rapid technological progress and in principle immortality, combine to make value lock-in a real possibility. Using AGI, there are a number of ways that people could extend their values much farther into the future than ever before. First, people may be able to create AGI agents with goals closely aligned with their own, which would act on their behalf. A lot of work has already been done on how to align AI with human intentions, such as by developing AI systems that are able to copy the behavior of people or infer their goals. Second, the goals of an AGI could be hard-coded. Someone could carefully specify what future they want to see and ensure that the AGI aims to achieve it. Third, people could potentially upload, scan their brain at high resolution and then emulate its structure on a computer. Just as modern computers can enable you to play retro computer games by running an emulation of old video consoles, a future computer could replicate the functions of a human brain by emulating it digitally. This emulation would be functionally the same as the uploaded mind, living on in digital form. Finally, some combination of these techniques could be used. The first two pathways are simply extensions of existing AI research. Would we yield such unprecedented power responsibly? Worryingly, the pursuit of value lock-in has been common throughout history. We saw that when the Qin took control of China, they undertook a program to systematically eradicate competing schools of thought. Similarly, the Han systematized Confucian teachings to the detriment of competing schools. The Maoists, too, desired to lock in their own values indefinitely, if only they had the power. They saw moral disagreement as the biggest problem in the world, and thought that the solution was to ensure that everyone had the same values. They told a parable of bygone sage kings who set up a chain of command from themselves all the way down to the lowest peasants. At each step of the chain, the subordinate would copy the values of their superior perfectly. This would carry on until Maoist values had been perfectly transmitted to all members of society. Similarly, in the previous chapter, I gave examples of religious crusades and ideological purges that aimed to eliminate people who advocated for different values. Some of these, like Stalin's Great Purge, were highly successful. In the previous chapter, I discussed how the theory of cultural evolution explains why many moral changes are contingent. The same theory also explains why they can be so persistent. When we look at history, we see that the predominant culture in a society tends to entrench itself, eliminate the competition, and take steps to replicate itself over time. Indeed, many moral views regard their own lock-in as desirable. As I mentioned in the last chapter, cultural evolution partly explains why. Those cultures that do not entrench themselves in this way will, over time, be more likely to die off than those that do. This results in a world increasingly dominated by cultures with traits that encourage and enable entrenchment and thus persistence. The pursuit of lock-in could also be a side effect of the pursuit of immortality, for example, via mind uploading, combined with an unwillingness to give up power. A desire for immortality has been very common throughout history. As early as the 2nd millennium BC, the Epic of Gilgamesh told a story in which Gilgamesh, who was probably a real-life king, attempts to secure eternal life. We also already noted the first Qin emperor's search for immortality. Here he was not unique. For thousands of years in China, immortality on Earth was a popular aim. One history of Chinese chemistry describes dozens of substances and potions for eternal life, tested by emperors and alchemists throughout much of this period. In the last century, many authoritarian or totalitarian rulers were interested in or actively pursued life extension. Stalin expressed an interest in the topic, and according to one Soviet defector, this prompted scientists to make life extension a central subject of Soviet medical research. North Korea's Kim Il-sung set up a longevity center devoted to keeping him alive and received blood transfusions from citizens in their 20s in an attempt to live longer. Nursultan Nazarbayev, the authoritarian ruler of Kazakhstan between 1990 and 2019, tasked Kazakh scientists with the prolongation of life. But after spending 2 years and millions of dollars, they disappointingly only managed to produce a probiotic yogurt called Nar. More recently, many wealthy techno-optimists have provided hundreds of millions of dollars in funding for biomedical R&D companies aiming to achieve indefinite lifespans. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel have both invested in San Francisco-based Unity Biotechnology, a company whose mission is to prevent aging. In 2013, Google launched the company Calico, which also aims to combat aging, with more than $1 billion in funding. Ambrosia, a California startup, charges its elderly customers $8,000 for injections of 2.5 liters of blood plasma harvested from teenagers. Even if aging cannot be cured in our lifetime, some people plan to punt the problem to the future by paying for cryonics, having their body or severed head frozen in the hope that resurrection will be possible with future technology. Whole-body cryopreservation with the Alcor Life Extension Foundation costs $220,000. It costs less than half that if one merely preserves one's head. Some entrepreneurs hope to abandon meat-based bodies altogether and live on in digital form through computer emulation of their brains. Nectome, a Y Combinator-funded startup that preserves brains with the hope that future generations will scan and upload them, counts Silicon Valley entrepreneur Sam Altman as a customer. Nectome's founder, Robert McIntyre, describes the service as 100% fatal. If the aim of locking in values and the desire for immortality have been so common throughout history, then we should expect many people to have those aspirations in the future too. AGI could allow them to become a reality. AGI could affect who has power too. AGI might be developed by a company or the military, and power could be in their hands rather than the hands of states. International organizations or private actors may be able to leverage AGI to attain a level of power not seen since the days of the East India Company, which in effect ruled large areas of India in the 18th and 19th centuries. AGI could not just upend the international balance of power, it could also reshape which kinds of actors matter most in world affairs. If we don't design our institutions to govern this transition well, preserving a plurality of values and the possibility of desirable moral progress, then a single set of values could emerge dominant. They may be those championed by a single individual, the elites of a political party, the populace of a country, or even the whole world. If this happened, then the ruling ideology could in principle persist as long as civilization does. AGI systems could replicate themselves as many times as they wanted, just as easily as we can replicate software today. They would be immortal, freed from the biological process of aging, able to create backups of themselves and copy themselves onto new machines whenever any piece of hardware wears out. And there would no longer be competing value systems that could dislodge the status quo. This section so far has been premised on people aligning AGI with their goals. But they may well fail. The attempt to lock in values through AGI would run a grave risk of an irrecoverable loss of control to the AGI systems themselves, which, if misaligned and uncontrolled, would kill the AGI's developers as well as everyone else. This is the risk I now turn to. AI takeover. If we build AGI, it will likely not be long before AI systems far surpass human abilities across all domains, just as current AI systems far outperform humans at chess and Go. And this poses a major challenge. To borrow an analogy from Ajaya Kotra, a researcher at Open Philanthropy, think of a child who has just become the ruler of a country. The child can't run the country themselves, so they need to appoint an adult to do so in their place. Their aim would be to find an adult who will act in accordance with their wishes. The challenge is for the child to do this, rather than, say, appointing a schemer who is good at deceitful salesmanship, but once in power would pursue their own agenda, even though the adults are much smarter and more knowledgeable than the child is. This risk was the focus of Nick Bostrom's book, Superintelligence. The scenario most closely associated with that book is one in which a single AI agent designs better and better versions of itself, quickly developing abilities far greater than the abilities of all humanity combined. Almost certainly, its aims would not be the same as humanity's aims. And in order to better achieve its aims, it would try to gain resources and try to prevent threats to its survival. It would therefore be incentivized to take over the world and eliminate human beings or permanently suppress them. Recent work has looked at a broader range of scenarios. The move from subhuman intelligence to superintelligence need not be ultra-fast or discontinuous to pose a risk. And it need not be a single AI that takes over. It could be many. We could see human beings gradually lose control as AI systems become a larger and larger share of the world economy. Eventually, we would share the fate of, say, chimpanzees or ants vis-a-vis humans, ignored at best and with no say over the future of civilization. To avoid such disempowerment, people would need to ensure that the AIs did what their operators wanted them to do. This is known as the alignment problem. It's discussed at length in other excellent books, like Superintelligence, Stuart Russell's Human Compatible, and Brian Christian's The Alignment Problem, so I won't go into it in depth here. Often, the risk of AI takeover is bundled with other risks of human extinction. But this is a mistake. First, not all AI takeover scenarios would result in human extinction. If human beings wanted to make chimpanzees extinct, we could. But we choose not to. We have no reason to, because they are not a threat to human hegemony. Similarly, even if superintelligent AGIs take over, they might well have so much more power than humans that they have no need to kill us off. Second, and more important, from a moral perspective, AI takeover looks very different from other extinction risks. If humanity were to go extinct from a pandemic, for example, and no other species were to evolve to build civilization in our place, then civilization would end, and life on Earth would end when the expanding sun renders our planet uninhabitable. In contrast, in the AI takeover scenarios that have been discussed, the AI agents would continue civilization, potentially for billions of years to come. It's an open question how good or bad such a civilization would be. As an analogy, imagine you are a member of an island nation, considering two ways in which your nation might end. First, a plague could kill everyone on your island. The island would thereafter be uninhabited. Second, colonizers could invade, wipe out everyone on the island, and afterwards build a different nation on the island with, let us assume, worse values. The future of this island would be very different under each of these two scenarios, and its moral assessment would be very different too. Even if you thought that the absence of future generations was not a moral loss, and even if you thought that the extinction of humans on your island via plague would be a good thing, morally speaking, you would still want to prevent the invasion of your island by the colonizers. By preventing the plague, you would enable the continuation of your nation rather than nothingness. By preventing colonization, you would enable the continuation of your nation rather than its replacement by some other nation with worse values. In the same way, even if superintelligent AGI were to kill us all, civilization would not come to an end. Rather, society would continue in digital form, guided by the AGI's values. What's at stake when navigating the transition to a world with advanced AI, then, is not whether civilization continues, but which civilization continues. For this reason, even if you think that the absence of future generations is not a moral loss, or that the end of civilization would be a good thing, issues that I discuss in part 4, it's still very important to avoid AI takeover or the lock-in of bad values. There will be future generations of intelligent beings either way, and by preventing the takeover of the world by an AI with bad values, you are changing how good or bad the future is over the course of civilization's lifespan. That's the main effect, rather than any impacts on civilization's life expectancy. The key issue, in my view, is not whether humans or AIs are in control. Either way, AGI is a way for values to get locked in indefinitely. The key issue is which values will guide the future. These values could be narrow-minded, parochial, and unreflective. Or they could be open-minded, ecumenical, and morally exploratory. If lock-in is going to occur either way, we should push towards the latter. But transparently removing the risk of value lock-in altogether is even better. This has two benefits, both of which are extremely important from a long-termist perspective. We avoid the permanent entrenchment of flawed human values. And by assuring everyone that this outcome is off the table, we remove the pressure to get there first, thus preventing a race in which the contestants skimp on precautions against AGI takeover or resort to military force to stay ahead.